It's really lovely to welcome Roy McFarlane to our Ledbury Poetry Salon.
Thank you.
And I don't know was anyone at Roy's reading at the last time that Roy read at Ledbury Poetry Festival?
No.
Oh, a few people. So. Was that last year?
July the 5th or something like that.
Deborah Alma.
Yeah,
lovely. So we're going to do things a bit differently then this time, we thought. So we're going to weave the conversation and the poetry together, which is going to really throw Roy all the time, because I'll bring up want to talk about all the poems that you don't read usually, which will make things interesting. And as is usual with our poetry salons, because we're a very small space, it's really intimate, it means we can, everyone please feel free to jump in and ask questions, and that's really lovely when that happens, so that would be great. So, what we're going to do is, first of all, we're going to talk about poems from Beginning With Your Last Breath, which is Roy's, it was your first full collection, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then we're going to end with some new poems. So we'll have a really lovely finale of new work. So that's how it's going to work. But we're going to begin with, just to get our listening ear ready, we're going to begin with a couple of poems by Roy. So please welcome Roy to Ledbury Poetry Salon.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for so many people turning up on this beautiful night, kind of thing. Could be out in your back garden with with some wine or something, couldn't you? This man's shaking his head, definitely. But I hope equally you'll be, the poems that I read and the conversations that we have will be equally as sweet and doesn't drunk you too much. Okay, I'll start off with a couple of poems, and for those who've heard these poems, I'm sorry, but I hope you still feel the energy and the love that I hope I've put into these poems. Yes, let's start off with what I always do. The poems, the collection is in four parts, and the first part is about my journey finding out that I was adopted. Now, I won't read the first poem, but that's literally the first time I hear from my mom, my life mother, that at the age of 13, she calls me up to her bedroom and she tells me out of the blue that I was adopted. And it's like, wow, are you kidding me? And for me, my life mother was all that I knew. I was adopted at the age of 6 months. So that's all I know is my life mother. So about a couple of years later, I'm about 16 or 18, and my birth mother tries to get in contact with me, and she sends me some beautiful pictures. She looks beautiful, and on top of that, I've got an older sister that kind of freaks me out, because that means there were two of us, and, well, that freaks me out, and you probably can understand that. And then there are two other younger siblings in the picture, and here's the poem. I believe it's what you call a villanelle. This is I'd written a couple of villanelles, and my publisher said, every good collection should only have one. Anyway, The Weight of Knowing. The woman in the photograph, surrounded by siblings looking just like me, this was the woman who gave me away. And now she wanted to know me, trying to connect to me. Unbelievable, coming from the woman in the photograph. It was my turn to reject, stuff my emotions away, ready to make a quick getaway, because this was the woman who gave me away. The weight of knowing her was too heavy to put on, and my anger tipped the scales beyond reason. The woman in the photograph sent me letters to leave me in a spell, but I was conjured by memories that this was the woman who gave me away. And those eyes telling their tales and untold stories couldn't change the fact of the woman in the photograph. This was the woman who gave me away. Thank you. And I guess that was the, that was like, I guess I was slightly emotional, just slightly. And I did actually refuse to see her or communicate with her. And if you buy the collection, you'll see what happens. I've got to always do that. Actually, this one I've not shared too often, so I'll share this one as well. This one's called Painting, and there's this beautiful picture on the front. It's a famous Caribbean poet, or Black British poet, called Sonia Boyce. And this painting is called She Ain't Holding Them Up, She's Holding On, Some English Rose. And I guess when writing this collection and we're thinking of a cover, this painting just stood out to me because it's got this beautiful Caribbean woman holding her family above her head, and in that picture it could be there are two kids, and it's quite interesting, a son and a daughter, possible husband and maybe a mother, and this very young woman is holding this family above her head, and I thought this sums up probably the journey that my mum was going through. All that burden she was carrying. So this one's called Painting. I saw my mother in this painting of Sonia Boyce, the woman wearing a cerise dress with black roses, holding her family above her head, a basket of life. And like her, she was holding us up. Her load no lighter for having two babies, out of wedlock, holding on, making a life in strange places, fighting the struggle of womanhood. Love evaded her twice, men she couldn't hold on to, no matter how wide she opened her heart. Holding onto any job whilst handing over her babies to be held by others until she returned, tired and weary. Holding on to hope that a childless couple would take care of the one she'd leave behind, knowing that her last breath upon his skin would be a new beginning. Thank you. So yes, I won't read any more from that first part because I really would like you to buy the book so you can see what happens, right? But the second selection is about a black young man, which is me, growing up, which I love this, in the black country. I love that, a black man growing up in the black country. For those who probably don't know about the black country, it's kind of situated between Wolverhampton and Birmingham, like Tipton, Dudley, Coesley. I wonder if Coesley's in there. But anyway, Tipton, Dudley, and a lot of other places like that. Aylesbury and other places like that. And it was called the Black Country, if I remember correctly, because Queen Victoria passed through there in the late 1800s. And because of the Industrial Revolution, and it was constantly smoke, and it's so dark, she called it the Black Country and held on to that name, the Black Country. So I just thought, yeah, I'm going to grab onto that. Black man in the Black Country. And I love doing this one because I kind of see people about approximately my age, and I can't do this with 20-year-olds or 30s because they won't have an idea of the stuff I'm saying here. But this is a period of time that I was I was 18 and going to my godfather's flat and looking, it's like looking after the home while he went out to, 9 times out of 10 is when he went down to the bookies and he was down there for hours kind of thing. But actually, it was when he went to work or something like that, I had to look after the house for him. And this one's called The Black Corner of Wolverhampton. The place, actually, if anybody knows this area, it's called Blakemore, right? Mm-hmm. And this is one of those magic things when you do writing, words come together. I look up for the, you know, what does Blakemore mean, where's it coming from? And it's an Anglo-Saxon word where Blake is black and Henall is a corner. I thought, yeah. Black man from the Black Corner of Wolverhampton. Here we go. Black Corner of Wolverhampton. house sitting for my godfather on the 9th floor of Blakemore Flats, the black corner of Wolverhampton. A world where I looked out to far horizons, reached beyond glass panes, touched the whites of the skies. A world all to myself when we went out to, when he went to work into the cool of the night, warning me with his Sammy Davis Jr. smile not to put on his snakeskin shoes as he closed the door behind him. A world all to myself with the TV on through the night, watching Richard Pryor live, swallowed up in a retro black swivel armchair until earth, wind and fire transported me to Boogie Wonderland. A world where you could see smoke rise from chimneys, and if you blinked, you'd swear that you saw someone fall. Where nights rode the back of velvet-coloured skies and Vertigo was more than a Hitchcock movie. A world where I voyaged to the bottom of the sea to command of the sea view. I was a black spy for the men from Uncle, kissed Lieutenant Uhuru on the SS Enterprise and fell back to Earth. A world where I put on my polo neck, rolled up my sleeve and bounced with attitude. I was Shaft, that bad mother, diving over sofas, moving from room to room with a cocked finger. A world where Hustler fell out of turned over sofas, turning page after page of exposed flesh, centerfolds wide open, eyes devouring forbidden fruits before a gallery of my godfather and Christ looking down on me. A world where people actually flew out of nightmares and guardian angels didn't fly just in time to prevent the graffiti of pavements and walls with the ending of people's hopes and dreams. A world which came to an end the night my godfather threw me out, returning early to Marvin Gaye playing love songs and me squeezing the life out of his snakeskin shoes with my size 10s.
Oh, wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. These are wonderful poems to read and wonderful to hear, and it's superb that to have both. So I've now got to try not to be a spoiler and give away what happens in the first part. But, I mean, starting with the last poem, I think this is a collection partly about finding places and spaces that are havens, or is that, do you think there's a set, because there's the lovely poem about Patterson as well, the house that
the lighthouse.
Yeah.
Yes. Lighthouse for all seasons. I guess if I look back at myself growing up as a single child in this beautiful home that I had, I was always looking for places to explore, to find peace, these havens, as it were, kind of thing. I was always, even going to school, I'd travel through the fields and all the areas, anywhere I could find somewhere where I can chill out, because I was always talking to myself. That's what you do. Well, that's what I did as an only child, creating these worlds, like what I, imagine that I was a black spy for the men from Uncle and things like that. So yeah, I think, especially in those early days, I'm always looking for spaces. And I think spaces is about what you do when you find these spaces, how you find your identity, maybe, how you explore identity, how you explore who you are. Sometimes, I guess, places are a place where, when I look at the Patterson's house, I was a young Christian. My father was a minister of the gospel, he was a deacon. And growing up, I was expected to follow his footsteps. And I guess I was very, my mom had brought me up on the Psalms and the Bible kind of thing. So I didn't get nursery rhymes. When you watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And the £100, £200 questions where just end the nursery rhyme? I'd always get screwed up on it. For £200, I'd get screwed up, because I wouldn't know the nursery rhymes. But ask me about the Psalms or the biblical, anything about the Bible, I could do that kind of thing. And that's what my mum brought me up on. And when we talk about Paterson House, and that's probably something I'll read later, Paterson was this elderly man that didn't put any pressure on us as young men growing up, kind of thing, while we were being, while, you know, as a young man, you're getting to know young women, you're getting to look at sexuality, the world around you, but the church wants you to be absolutely holy and righteous and spiritual, and you've got to be there 7 days a week. Paterson's House was like this place of freedom. Paterson was real. Paterson understood what we were going to. We could talk to Paterson about girls. We could chill out in Paterson's. And that's that kind of place where you escape. That's it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it comes out in the collection that there's also poems, particularly about your friend Bevan, and this sense of these, which are like, you capture these moments, and please tell me, it's threat. There is times of threat, isn't there, in the collection? It comes out really clearly as well. That, this place that you're growing up in, even those fields with the snowstorm that comes, is a sort of thing of. So, I think that's an interesting contrast. We've got these havens or safer, these midway places between. And then, so could you talk a bit about that?
Bevan is a. And you know, it's quite interesting. It's rare that anybody talks about Bevan. In all this collection's been out for about 18 months, I think, and not many people have touched on Bevan, kind of thing. And Bevan is this recurring individual in the collection. He comes up in about 3 or 4 poems, kind of thing. And again, I wanted to show, if you look at the poetry that I do, and when I put a collection together, I try to do a narrative. I do try to put together a string of a storyline and that kind of thing. So it's not only I like it not only to be a book that you pick poems out, but if you really get the time to just sit down from beginning to end, hopefully it's a nice little short story that you're getting. And Bevan is this guy, he's a friend, he's actually a collection of 3 or 4 guys that I knew. And they were very close friends, and it was again about our journey living in the Black Country around Wolverhampton and Tipton. And you're right, we had joys, and when we used to go to nightclubs and dance the night away to Lovers Rock, and we had our girlfriends. We also, so I'd be dancing on a Saturday night, sneak back in the house and go to church the next morning, kind of thing. And we would enjoy life, but equally, being Black, and especially in the 80s, there was the threat of skinheads. And there is a story in there that we were chased, and it's parts true. The real story that's behind that is that I was on the bus coming back from Birmingham. We were in Wensbury, and this Black guy came off the bus being followed by 3 white skinheads, and they were out the field circling this Black guy. And I came off the bus because I felt he was on his own. I didn't know what to do. And I was just coming from church, if I remember correctly, as well. And when they saw me come off the bus, the 3 skinheads ran off, kind of thing. And so that story is retold in a slightly different way, but and it includes Bevan. I wanted to show the joys, the pleasures, the safe havens, but also that fear. And that danger that was always around us. And it's quite powerful that you've talked about the last poem. And again, in all of this, hopefully you see that my mum was the greatest safe haven. She was that beautiful place. And the last poem kind of shows my journey coming from school. I was about 14, 15. It's one of them real terrible snows coming down. It's pouring down. And I could just hear my mum say, "You're nearly there." And it's if you look, there's a story that I tell of myself and my daughter, where again that refrain is used, "You're nearly there." So for the collection, I used it again and repeated it where my mum's in my head telling me through a snowstorm, "You're nearly there," kind of things.
It's really interesting what you've said about this arc of the collection, because that's really strong. And there is this thing of things repeating, refrains or phrases coming back in through the collection, which I think is really strong and pulls you through. And it, you know, it sort of makes you, I feel I want to ask then about, or talk a bit about beginning with your last breath, because it comes up in an early poem. It's there again at the end, and it creates a kind of sense of a circle. Tell us about that. How did it come? And why is it? How did it make it to the title?
So the reason why I go yes, because there's only about three or four people that have really hit that note about the circle that I try to keep on repeating. And so even though my mum passes away, I believe there's a circle that continues in me. My mum continues in me. Circle of life. So it's never ending, and that's the idea. Beginning with your last breath, nothing ever ends. It's a circle of life kind of thing. Don't get, what is it, Lion King kind
yes
of thing. But I forgot the question you asked.
Yeah, but it's also I suppose it's also interesting about breath as well. And also the religious element thing that's very strong. You know, you now it's clear you've very strong Christian still, I think. Okay. So I'm interested because breath is such a strong thing in the Bible. And,
yes, absolutely. You know, I can see that's always going to be in me. I still acknowledge that there's a greater power than me, but I want to call that Mother Nature, God, or the universe. But I guess in my collection, that was that constant knowledge that whether it's my mother's breath upon me or the breath, you know, the breath that we share with each other, I think that's the power that ignites us as a community kind of thing. And it's that thing that I kept repeating in there, that we are all part of one community, whether we're black, white, Muslim, Christian, and I think I'll try to bring it across. There's a poem in there about a riot that happened in Birmingham, and a Asian guy loses his son in the riot. And so he's holding his son in the bloodshed. He takes his son, or they take the son away. When he returns, the Asian community wants to revenge the black community, and the white, everybody's at each other's head, at each other. And this guy, who has just lost his son, basically says, stop. I've lost my son. I don't want anybody else to lose their sons. Nobody else can afford to lose their sons. I probably haven't quoted it correctly, but it's in there again. It's that value of breath that in life and everything else kind of thing.
Super. Do you want to read a few more? I think because we've talked about a few that you might.
I've lost the book.
Fancy. Oh, it's behind you.
Well, I guess what let's do the three that we talked about. Yeah. So Patterson's House. It is one of. If anybody asks me what's your favourite poem in there, I'd probably say this one's my favourite one. Yeah. Patterson's House. Patterson was the old man of the neighborhood, that young men drowning in oceans of puberty, navigating skies of spirituality, and living in times of uncertainty, found in him a lighthouse for all seasons. We brought our baggage, basketballs, and bicycles into the hall, laid our keys and bus passes on a table that took the weight of our anger, groaned under the guilt of sexual awakening, and was big enough for the vast canvas of blackness. We had the freedom of his house to walk into rooms filled with stories of how he lied about his age to join the Air Force, to be stationed in England, and after the war, loved and danced all night under Cuban sunsets, to leave on the dawn of revolutions, and ending up back in England to start a new life in Smerwick. Meeting Malcolm X on Marshall Street 9 days before they shot him in Harlem. Weekends were the best. A pot of soup on Saturdays that never ran out. Filled with answers, love and understanding. And on Sundays, chicken, rice and peas. And rivers flowing with Guinness punch. The light never went out at Patterson's. A place that felt like Beulah Land. Where heaven didn't feel so far away. And being a teenager didn't feel like a cross on our backs. Carried through fields of guilt. Which leads on to soup. Soup gets in this book. Soup, Saturday soup. Saturday soup is a real Caribbean tradition kind of thing. Our mum would create this big pot of soup. You go into any Caribbean house, there's a mum making that massive pot of soup where they put dumplings, potato, yam, sweet potato. They put everything in there. They get a goat from somewhere and they shove it in there. No, that's joking. But they put some kind of meat in there kind of thing. And it's this juicy, beautiful pot of soup that usually lasts for the whole weekend, right? So here we go, Saturday soup, and here's Bevan. First mention of Bevan. Actually, Bevan is mentioned before, but here we go. Saturday soup. Actually, I need to stand up to do this one. Bevan is smiling into his soup, juggling with the choice of dumpling or dashin to devour. Do you think things will ever get better for us? I'm hugging the bowl. My mother places before me. The smell draws me in. The swirling, twirling wisp of heat that snakes into the air hypnotizes me. He breaks the trance and continues. Yo, I'm sick and tired of all of this, pointing to the color of his skin. I'm tired of fighting and fitting in. I'm soaking on the bone. And I find a response amongst the sweet potatoes and cho-cho. War is not the answer. Only love can conquer hate. He laughed. We chewed on other thoughts and let Marvin Gaye tell us what's going on. I was writing city lyrics, the poetics of the oppressed. Bevan was an urban Rembrandt, drawing revolutions of the young. He was 6 foot wound up length of muscle. Oftentimes we'd wrestle and play, fight until bruises mushroom, leaving fallouts that blew away friendships for that split second. Barely standing until rescued by the bonds of laughter. We were brothers, not by blood, but by the late evenings where we sat in front of an electric fire, told stories to the dawn of a new morning. And wore out the tape of Enter the Dragon. What's the other thing we said? Yeah, I want to do that Saving Our Songs. I really want to do that one. Saving Our Songs. Blacks, this is the quote, that this is literally what he came out with. And remember, this guy's just lost his son, and this is about an hour later. Blacks, Asians, whites. We all live in the same community. Why do we have to kill one another? I lost my son. Step forward if you want to lose your son. Tariq Jahan, father of Haroon Jahan, killed in the Birmingham riots, August 2011. A father's hands are red. He's trying like a midwife to keep him alive in the cradle of his arms. The heat of his body, the warmth of his breath, ebbing away in the midst of rioting. The chaos and the destruction, the dark abyss of madness drawn from the womb of our city. There's vengeance and violence swiftly swelling and poisoning the blood that flows through young minds. Hours later, the father who has lost his son needs an antidote for the growing toxicity. He refuses to lose another, and with outstretched hands pleading to a crowd for the insanity to stop, he cries for the rebirth of hope that will save our sons. Okay, I'll give you the first part of Nearly There. This is about me and my daughter, right? My daughter was doing a lot of dance, she's about 7. She was doing a lot of drama, a lot of dance kind of thing. And we're coming back from the centre on the bus. It's a beautiful summer's day like yesterday, and then out of the blue a storm comes out. We come off the train, it's like it's pouring down, right? Nearly there. Do you remember the day we got caught in a torrential downpour? We just stepped off the bus on a summer's day, and we had to make a decision to stay under cover or run the gauntlet of the rain. We ran. I urged, pulled and dragged you along. Watched those little legs scurry along and keep on telling you, we're nearly there. I'm your father. What else could I say? So I covered you in my bomber jacket under a shower of rain as the windows of Evan opened, turning roads into rivers and junctions into waterways. We walked on water, waded deep in ravines, and in a deluge of it all, I was overwhelmed with tears, and I kept on telling you, we're nearly there. And when we were finally there, we got rid of our wet clothes, wrapped you up in love, made you chocolate tea, and sat you down in front of a warm fire. I won't always be there when it pours, and it will pour, to drag you through the rain, to carry you along the way. But remember, when it rains, you're nearly there.
Oh, absolutely lovely. Is anybody wanting to ask anything or pitch in at this point? Or I do have a question that I wanted to... I mean, lots of things have come up for me as I'm hearing you read, but I am keen to chat to you about a different side of the poems in this book, which is there's really a very strong and wonderful sensuality in the book, which is such a pleasure, I think. And so I wanted to ask particularly, I mean, there's two poems particularly which are about female bodies, and they're just about, you know, really making beautiful the sort of parts of female bodies that perhaps are not considered attractive, the blemishes or the scars.
Okay, yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because it's for me, a very pleasurable feature of the book, and so how to read
it. Okay, the third part, I've had lovely fun with this. Third part is about love. There are parts very sensual. I think when myself and my publisher, Jane Kamane, we're thinking about putting in this collection. Jane said, bring everything that you've written. And she loved all this sensual, loving part. And she thought it was important. It's a part of who you are, Roy. And it's beautiful. So let's get it, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's about me. And I'm stuttering now. it's about me and my love for women. And I am down to one woman now, and I'm sticking with one woman now. I think a lot of that comes from my mom. She was a very tactile, very loving lady. I was drowned and in love, and I kind of shared that on my journey. And so that's what I've tried to capture. And I've always wanted to capture sensuality and in a nice and sweet and beautiful way, and capture the beauty of a woman, and even with blemishes. And I have a beautiful partner now that as a scar from a burn that she got when she was 3-4 years old, and so it's under her neck, travels across that area, kind of thing. And funny thing, which I've not yet I've touched on in my first poem, my mom. That's quite interesting. That is, I hadn't thought about that. But my mom had a major scar on her throat, and she would never show it. She'd always button up her blouses up every time she went to church. Her blouses was always buttoned up. She would never show this major scar that was on her throat, kind of thing. And yet, I thought my mom was so beautiful. And I guess that's interesting. Now you've put that up. Now that I have a partner that has a scar that I talk about in the collection, and say, you're beautiful. And when I make love to you, and I talk about making love to her, how beautiful it looks while I'm making love to her, kind of thing.
It is. It's compared to Sedgley Beacon, which I haven't been to, but it's compared to a sort of play of light. And so it's really, and it's a lovely thing because some of the place poems have the kind of irony, and you know, it's a bit, there's a bit of love hate about the places that maybe that you grew up in. But this is just pure beauty, I thought, and makes me want to go to Sedgley Beacon.
This is a beautiful place, yeah. Small place, but it's beautiful when you get there. And there's the Tunks poem as well.
Yeah, lovely. Gorgeous. And also, though, you see, the lovely thing too is that you're tending also. I mean, when I was asking you the question, I was thinking of the poem about you cleaning your mother's leg, or So it's also about, you know, looking after your mum, but again with this lovely sensual beauty.
And again, she had scars on the leg, and she had a scar on the shin. Oh yeah, my mum told the story when she was growing up in Jamaica. She is the craziest thing you could do. You know, like young people growing up will have a debate with you, will say why every minute, will say, I don't care, and walk away. My mum, all my mum did to her mum when she was growing up, and she was about 16, and her mum had asked her to do something. And it was like my mum said, really? That's all. Nothing major, nothing argumentative. Her mum threw a stick and it lodged in her shin bone, and it just poured out with blood, and so she had a scar on her shin bone just for saying really kind of thing to her mum, kind of thing. And you'll see in the when my mum's passing away, and I'm with her in her last year of her life, kind of thing, one of the joys that I had was just oiling her legs and just keeping them, because as Caribbean skins, we can get ashy or dry up, kind of thing. It was just a joy of just looking after my mum while she was passing away, kind of thing.
Yeah, really, really, really lovely. So, I think that we said we'd leave time for some of your new poems, so I think we should certainly do that. I have so many things I want to ask you about music and about and the poem about your father's love letters. I was very curious about that.
People always say you always seem to talk about women and mothers, kind of thing. You never really touch about your dad. My life father was, like I said, he was a deacon, very strict guy, but to be honest, he was rarely around the house because he really threw himself into the work of God's, you know, as a minister of the gospel. He threw himself in there, helping others, going to church literally every day, spreading the gospel. So it was an interesting relationship I had with my dad. Perfect husband, you know, wonderful dad, but it's quite interesting that I don't really talk much about him, and maybe there's a bit of bitterness that you gave so much to the community, gave so much to people, and I don't feel that you gave to me. But it's funny how my mum would always say that every time he came in and I was asleep, he'd always come into the room. I'm not aware of that, but he would always come into the room when I was asleep and either give me a kiss on the head or whatever. So the only poem in there about my father, my life father, is the boxing, yes. And it's quite funny. I've been struggling with my dad on a journey, not being able to talk to him, hardly seeing him. It's when his last years, and especially when I had my son, suddenly me and my dad are talking. We're literally spars and we're bouncing off each other. And then we recognise this love that we had for boxing. And so there's a whole section about my father and boxing, going all the way back to Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson, so anybody who loves boxing, you've got to buy this, right?
Tipton Slasher's
in there as well, yeah. But the one about the love letter, that is a really kind of a fantasy about my birth father, because I have no idea who he is. My mum won't say who he is. It seems like just a one-night stand. He's supposed to be in the church as well. He's supposed to be a minister. One night stand, and he went and disappeared, and he wouldn't own up to it. And my mom saved him in the sense that he wouldn't give the name of who this guy was. So I never got to know who my birth father is. And so I write this imaginary fantasy of him writing love letters to all the people, all the women that he loved, kind of thing. So that's what that poem is, my father's love letters, kind of thing.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Well, shall we have a few more poems? Are we ready? Yes, definitely.
Does anybody want to ask any questions?
Yeah.
Do you have any scars?
I do. On my right ankle, got run over. There's a whole story with that as well, with my mum lifting me and taking me all the way to Dudley Guest Hospital. So yeah, I've got a scar on my ankle.
It's an interesting question though, because actually the book ends on I'm still in the throes of winter. but it doesn't actually, because there's not enough after that. So, but it's a wonderful book about scars and struggle, and the fabulous poem I Cried.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
About masculinity, I guess.
I'll tell you what, let me read that one, and then I'll give you some. I'm sorry.
Could you say something about your journey to becoming a poet?
Mm. Oh, well, I, the journey starts off when I'm in my 30s. I think I've been writing poetry or writing things all my life, kind of thing. And especially when I listen to people, and that's the reason why I got people in there like Marvin Gaye, George Benson, Steve. A lot. There's a jazz whole section about jazz artists. So their writings, their words were profound in the way I wrote things. But it was interesting that when I was about in my 30s, I had a youth project where I was working with young people that were either excluded from school or were on the streets. And they were writing a lot of really horrible misogynist lyrics in their hip-hop way kind of thing. And so my friend and myself, we challenged them. And so we started to write lyrics that wasn't so misogynistic and violent and whatever. Talk about life, talk about... So that's when I started to write poems. And then I think it was about a couple of years later, I got a job in Birmingham, and then I met this wonderful poet by the name of Roy Quabena. He was a Trinidadian poet that was residing in Birmingham, and he became the Birmingham Poet Laureate. And I showed him some of my stuff, and he said they were good, and this is what he did to me one day. 2003, approximately 2003, he says, I like your stuff. And I followed him around kind of thing. He says, you know, the next time you come, I've got an event at the Crescent Theatre. I'm going to be performing. I tell you what, I want to read your stuff afterwards, so make sure you bring your best stuff. Bring them with you, right? I come to the Crescent Theatre, I've got my stuff, I'm listening to Roy Quabena. I'm saying, yeah, this guy's brilliant. Oh, I love this guy. And there's something Roy Quabena. Well, there's a new young poet on the scene by the name of Roy McFarlane, and he's going to share with you two or three poems. And so I picked the best out of that and read. I was thrown into the deep end, and that was my baptism of fire. And from then I've been writing poems. I've been, most of the first 10 years would be a lot of slam poetry, stage performances and things like that. And then I met Jane Kamein, and that transition from the stage to the page kind of thing. And that's where I am. Yeah, but thank you.
Thank you. Mm.
Any other questions before we have final poems? Okay, so we're going to hear some new things as well.
Okay.
About 10 minutes
ten
or
minutes.
So, yeah.
Can we want to share that one you talked about?
Lovely.
The love poem, this one's a nice one. I cry. Thank you. And as my friend at the back will probably know, that sometimes when I read some of these poems, I get all emotional, doesn't it? So I'm sorry if I start blubbering and crying.
That's
all
right.
I cry. They say big men don't cry. Well, I've cried streams and rivers that flowed into oceans. I cried when my firstborn traveled across waters, resided deep in the sea palace for 9 months before entering into my world. Years later, I cried when I had to cleave open a ripe melon womb to scoop out the heart of flesh and redness that was my second child. And when my daughter made her appearance, I cried and she hollered, and I told her I would never let her go. I cried when I saw my wife coming down the aisle, and I told her I'd love her forever. The same tears that turned into anger and frustrations at the different roads we took, and all that we had turned into a crumbling tower of Babel. I cried
at the words we threw at each other, the landmines we walked upon, and the bitter barbed wire that wrapped around both of us. I cried when France won the World Cup, a multicultural team breaking walls of indifference. But the police put the walls back up, and the people rioted because another black man was shot on the streets of Paris. I cried at a tangerine-coloured sunset that I'll never see again, and moons so large that they fill lakes to overflowing. I've cried during the playing of Anita Baker, or was it the intense sweet loving of you, the way you cry when I place my mouth on you, devouring the rich, moist, honeyed centre of you, and the secrets that open like a bright pink rose. Oh, I cry with a passion when I enter you, rise in you, travel the length of this universe within you, rivers that pour into you and over you. I've loved angels without wings, who sing their hearts filled with love songs, making me cry in the springtime, only to watch love fall like autumn leaves. And I'm crying right now, watching my mum holding on, each cough, each grunt, watching her get ready to fly her maiden flight from my world into her paradise. They say big men don't cry, but I'm crying streams and rivers that are flowing into ocean. Okay. Yeah, let's go for this one. In a city of 100 times. This is part of the Knicks collection. It's called The Next Time, The Healing. This is a bit. This is a bit darker. But it looks really going into depths of issues of racism and isms and deaths in police custody. But there's hope in the last section where we meet a Rasta. Like really, this collection started off, or this poem started off with the idea of, you know, when you've seen, anybody else remember David Carradine in Kung Fu? Mm-hmm. And he's that wandering, wise guy, but then, you know what I mean? So that's what I was going to start off with, David Carradine, as this wise guy walking through Birmingham city centre. And I says, well, why can't it be a Rasta? I thought, let's go there. So good. And also, just for your ears, in Birmingham, 2013, 2014, they said there were 123 languages being spoken in Birmingham. I'm sure that's gone up now, kind of thing. But I just thought there's a beauty there. I know a lot of people see contention, they feel they're getting overrun or something like that. But I just think it's always been the journey of Great Britain, of England. For the last 2,000 years, you've been having all kind of Anglo, Saxon, Vikings, everything's been happening to build this beautiful language in this place that we're in. See, I'm getting excited, sorry. Okay. Here we go. In the city of 100 tongues. One. The night comes early in the city. Maybe lost, maybe on the run. But it's here to stay, it kneels and prays. Nervous in the illumination of street lamps. Arms outstretched. A barefoot Rasta stands outside Waterstones, and in a city of 100 tongues, in the tumult of identities, even in the din of it all, you can find amity in this beautiful city. Two. This barefoot Rasta walked into Central Station. This Rasta is swapping the sands of Morant Bay for the brown leaves crinkling under feet. This Rasta is not the famous Mutar Baruka. This Rasta is sitting in a cafe, breaking wisdom with a writer. This Rasta has been travelling a long, long way. This Rasta, is he fiction or is he truth? Three. Rasta, eating apple and cinnamon muffin. Rasta. If you were to die, What would your children think of you? Writer. That's interesting. Really interesting. Jeez, that's interesting. Rasta. Notice you have repeated yourselves 3 times. Rasta. Write that down. Don't think, but just write. A writer writes, and a barefoot Rasta is walking out the door. 4. Standing inside Waterstones, in between the good immigrant and why I'm no longer talking to white people about race, the writer watches the barefoot Rasta standing outside with his arms outstretched. 5. Remember, this Rasta is not Muta Baruka. This Rasta straddles histories of the colonized and the colonialist. This Rasta will not be policing state borders, but will stand in the gap in the midnight hour. This Rasta will at times embalm your empathy. This Rasta at times will mess up your mind. This Rasta will not be found on the BBC. This Rasta will be getting into your head. This Rasta will not be wearing dreads, but you won't have to chase him out of town. This Rasta will not be standing on the corner, but will be performing from the BT Tower. 6. With Waterstones behind him, arms outstretched and barefoot, a Rasta sinks into a multitude of tongues, bouncing off the soft palettes of black skies. And if all a man or a woman brings with them is their mother tongue, in the city of 100 tongues, we, you, and I should always make room for another tongue. Okay, so that third part is about a Rasta on a journey, bringing wisdom, but he's angry as well. Angry, wisdom, nice, all this kind of stuff. He travels through all time. He goes back. If anybody knows the Rastafarian movement, a lot of people think it's about 50 years old, from the time of Haile Selassie, the great king of Ethiopia. But actually, Rastafarians will say it goes all the way back to Solomon, King Solomon, when King Solomon met the Queen of Bathsheba. And the Ethiopians called Bathsheba Makeda. And there's this union between King Solomon and Bathsheba where they made love, and a child was born. And from that child, we have the Rastafarian movement. And Haile Selassie is supposed to be an ancestral, or what's the word? Heritage? Lineage? All the way back to that time. So I'm going to take you back with Rasta, and we're going back to the courts of Solomon. Solomon's love song. This Rasta traveled in the caravans of Makeda to the courts of Solomon, all the way from Sheba, bearing gold and spices in such quantity to discern his wisdom and popularity. 1001 tales, dark and intricate sayings, they shared in the mornings and in the heat of the evenings. And when she had communed of all that was in her heart, it was he who inquired of love and sang through the night. And Solomon gave Makeda all her desire, and together they lay in sweet surrender until sheets of velvet night sunk into distant horizon where they knew each other disrobed in a new dawn. Makeda rose and returned with the song of Solomon within her, and all the ships of Ophir couldn't fill Solomon's empty chamber. And finally, some of these poems have been recommended and won a few competitions. That was The Verve. And this one was Winchester Poetry Prize. And I'm going to finish off with this. 1999, this is the opening poem of the collection. And it's called Parts of a Broken Mind. And I do a section from 1999 to 2006. So it's going to be interesting, right? 1999, Parts of a Broken Mind. On Sunday, the preacher speaks of revelation, and repentance. The end of the world is on the lips of news reporters, cults are growing, and in the basement of a computer department, they're preparing for the invasion of the Millennium Bug. We watch for the skies and Mr. Stones at our feet. He shoots a basketball, graceful in motion, and everybody's watching the flight of the ball, reaching its zenith, then beginning to fall. All things fall. Summer rain, falling from grace, before that of a sordid affair. The ball falling. Grapefruit, soursop, planting. A Saturday morning's ritual. Roles change. A son takes his mother to a Caribbean store in Bilston Market. She's not as strong as she used to be, her breathing labored, but she snaps the heads, digs out the eyes. Yellow yam, sweet potatoes, dashing. A nation hears no evil, sees no evil, speaks no evil. A son's blood, a father's sweat, and a mother's tears will lead a retired judge and three diverse men to sit on the branches of communities, and the rocks will hear and rivers speak of the death of Stephen Lawrence. After hearing the death of Grover Washington Jr., a family man falls asleep with his Walkman headphones between wine light and come morning. Memories awake in the whirl of cassette tapes, beginning the rewind of illicit love. Just the two of us, building those castles in the sky. Late meetings, lips kissing, hands feeling, fingers. Her halter neck top drawn over her head, the night air touches her breasts, powdered with a flurry of goosebumps. He sucks greedily, and it all begins again. There are no purple skies, but the prophet prince lives to see his words come alive as people party like it's 1999. We could die any day. James Byrd Jr. died the year before, lynching by dragging. Hate is driving for miles in a pickup truck, driving from century. A new job, a new millennium. But the more a man has, the more a man wants. And a family man leaves doors unclosed, doors that ache in the wind.